Il-program li ser tisimaw uwa miġju plilkom bixxewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM 103.7. I'm Patricia Cavalleri, and in this series we shall be hearing from academics about their research and from students and other members of the campus community about the many activities which will be taking place during the coming year. I'm delighted to have with me today on University Matters on Campus FM, Professor Marilyn Clark. Just a few words about my guest. Professor Clark is an associate professor within the Department of Psychology here at the University of Malta. That sits within the Faculty for Social Wellbeing. She holds a master's degree in social psychology from the University of Liverpool and a PhD from the University of Sheffield. Her main research interests are addiction, gender, criminal careers, stigma, and youth studies. She has published extensively in peer-reviewed journals and in a number of academic texts. In Malta, she chaired the National Commission on the Abuse of Drugs, Alcohol, and Other Drugs, is an assistant to the magistrate on the Juvenile Court, and a member of the Centre for Freedom from Addictions, President's Foundation for the Wellbeing of Society. Welcome to the programme, Professor Clark.
Thank you.
Well, you've been involved in many different projects these last years, and we're going to take three, I think, today and have a little chat about each of them. They're very different projects, but obviously linked to your area of expertise, which is psychology. The first one I thought we could speak about is this publication that has come out, The Gender Dimension of Non-Medical Use of Prescription Drugs in Europe and the Mediterranean Region. It's a bit of a mouthful, so I'm hoping you'll explain it a little bit to us. Perhaps we could start off by looking into how you got involved in it and who is involved, and then obviously what it led to.
Okay, so the study is in fact a study by the Pompidou Group, which is the arm of the Council of Europe that deals with drug policy. And the Pompidou Group has long, as early as 1984, been discussing how gender is a very important dimension when we're talking about addiction. It was perhaps one of the first entities within the field of addiction that alerted sort of the international community on the gender dimension and how important gender mainstreaming is in drugs policy. Following this, a number of projects have addressed the issue of gender, and a number of entities have taken this on. But the Pompidou Group, in 2013, created the post of a gender rapporteur within their entity, and this is the representative from Italy, and they decided to make a voluntary contribution in terms of funding, which would focus on the gender dimension. I had been involved in the Pompidou Group together with my colleague Professor Richard Muscat. Malta was in fact held the vice presidency for the Pompidou Group, and they identified me as a potential person to lead this project on gender. Why non-medical use of prescription drugs? Again, sort of the gender dimension in the field of addictive behavior has highlighted how we have a very significant gender gap when it comes to addiction. This means basically that men are more likely to use drugs, more likely to get involved problematically with drugs, more likely to enter treatment, more likely to be involved in the criminal justice system in relation to substances. We have termed this the gender gap. We do know, however, that the gender gap is narrowing, probably as a result of changing roles of women in modern societies. However, with the non-medical use of prescription drugs, the gender gap is actually reversed. So, we do know from other research prior to this one that women are more likely to use prescription medication and also to abuse or use non-medically than do men, for a number of reasons which perhaps we'll get a chance to discuss. So basically, the Pompidou Group asked me to lead a working group. I did not do this project by myself. A working group whereby we decided to explore the phenomenon within the Council of Europe member states and also some of the Mediterranean states that are associated within the MedNet project. And we decided to sort of develop the area a little bit further.
The methodology you used, however, was quite specific.
Yes, essentially, in America, this was our starting point. We knew from mainly literature and research that's taking place in America that women are sort of overrepresented in the use of non-medical use of prescription drugs. However, in Europe, the phenomenon has not been explored extensively. In other words, there was a great gap. So we were aware that while we clearly monitor very effectively, primarily through the work of the European Monitoring Centre on Drugs and Drug Addiction, the EMCDDA, which is the EU body that is tasked with monitoring in Europe. And for drugs, for illicit drugs, we have a very, very clear picture, and we know, you know, who uses what drugs, etc. However, when it comes to non-medical use of prescription drugs, it's been something that has not been monitored effectively in Europe, and there were lots of gaps. So basically, however, we did know from some monitoring and also from the American data that women face particular issues in this regard. So basically, the project, the working group was tasked with developing this project, which had a number of aims. So the first thing was to explore the gender dimension in relation to non-medical use of prescription drugs, but primarily to explore what the state of monitoring was in Europe and in the Mediterranean region, to see what data we have, and especially to see what data we don't have, so to identify the gaps, always keeping the gender dimension in mind. So we wanted to also explore what the gaps were and therefore make recommendations for how these gaps can be closed. The research also sort of wanted to make recommendations for policy development as well as for practice.
And so the type of methodology used was to ask...
Okay, so I'll talk a little bit about the methodology in very generic terms. Essentially, what the study did not attempt to collect any primary data. That would be too big in scope. It is also not the role of the Pompidou Group to collect primary data.
That was an interesting point that I wanted to bring out in actual fact.
Right. So basically what we did is we identified, well, the Pompidou Secretariat identified experts in a number of member states that agreed to participate. Normally these were people who were nominated by the permanent correspondents for that particular country, and they were often members of the national focal points or members of employees of ministries that are responsible for collecting data. So they were individuals who would have had access to data if it were to exist. So basically then we devised a questionnaire, a rather lengthy questionnaire, addressing a number of, or trying to tap a number of data sources. For example, general population surveys, youth surveys, hospital admissions, fatal and non-fatal overdose data, policy documents, and the like. Okay, so a number of data sources were sort of captured with the questionnaire. 17 countries finally agreed to participate, a number of European countries.
I was going to say, were these all European countries?
No, they weren't. Some were Mediterranean countries, so we had Morocco, Lebanon, Egypt as well. And basically, the questionnaires were sent out to the experts, and when they were completed and sent back, we analyzed, looking primarily at two aspects. So the first part of, in fact, of the research report examines what the situation, the monitoring situation in these countries are. So we looked at, okay, what data is available in these countries? Do they have a population survey? Does the population survey address the non-medical use of prescription drugs, or does it only address illicit substance? What about youth surveys? Do they keep hospital admission data? Do they document fatal and non-fatal overdoses in relation to prescription medication? So the first part of the report documents the state of monitoring. The second part goes into the gender differences. Okay, so basically, to talk a little bit about the state of monitoring, I mean, the first glaringly blatant result in the study is that in European countries, there is no standard monitoring practice for the non-medical use of prescription drugs that allows us to identify differences in relation to gender. Essentially, one of the biggest problems is that even in general population surveys where we ask people to report about their drug use, general population, there is not made in these surveys a clear distinction between the use of prescription drugs and the non-medical use of prescription drugs, because this is a very important difference. So the non-medical use of prescription drugs is the use of a drug that is not in accordance with medical practice. It might have been prescribed to you by a doctor, but you are using it differently. So the doctor might tell you, have one of these with a glass of water before you go to sleep, and you have it with a glass of whiskey first thing in the morning. Clearly, that you might have a prescription for it, but you are using it non-medically. On the other hand, you may not have a prescription for it. So you may, we do know that prescription medication is also trafficked on the black market. You may be given to it. You might not buy it on the black market in the street, but you might be given it by a friend or by a family member. So, you know, you're having difficulty sleeping and your friend tells you, okay, you know, have one of these, they might help you sleep, etc. So we found primarily that the monitoring, there is a lot of gaps in monitoring, and we made a number of recommendations, in fact, to the MCDDA, and I am pleased to say that a number of these recommendations have actually been put into the work program of the MCDDA. So they have listened to the recommendations that the Pompidou group has made in this regard. I must also say that the non-medical use of prescription drugs was also on the list of priorities of the Luxembourg presidency of the EU Commission, so in relation to drugs. So there was a push on putting non-medical use of prescription drugs clearly on the agenda, and the MCDDA appears to have taken this up. The second part of the report, in terms of the results, looked more at the gender differences. So here we found clearly that amongst the limited data that we collected, so I must say that the data is very limited and the results need to be interpreted with immense caution, because there was no standardized collection of data amongst the 17 countries. So it was very hard to compare the data that was submitted. But clearly, the use of prescription drugs, as well as the abuse of prescription drugs, is higher, much higher for women. It is much higher in general populations. It's much higher in youth surveys. Fatal overdoses and hospital admissions appear to be higher for women. And clearly, the recommendations were that we need to explore this further. I must also say that a systematic literature review was conducted for the study. So that in itself also indicated how women are particularly a high-risk category for non-medical use of prescription drugs, and one of the main risk factors for women is the experience of trauma and interpersonal violence. And sort of another recommendation that the Pompidou group made is that, or that was made in this report, was that the issue of violence amongst women and the use of substances be explored further. And once again, this was an issue which was taken up further by the Pompidou group and resulted in another research project and a conference last November. So a number of follow-on effects coming from this particular project.
This is always a very important point, and obviously with a prestigious group like the Pompidou group, this would happen, that there would be follow-up. And I can see that this report has been extremely important in identifying, as you say, the gaps and identifying the situation, in the hope that obviously things can be improved and follow-ups can be made and policies can be changed and developed, really.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think sort of, you know, we talk a lot about evidence-based policy. So clearly what we do need to develop is a strong research base on this. And clearly while in the United States this has been taken on, in Europe we're still lagging a bit behind. But I think this project, if it did anything, was alert the entities who do monitor substance abuse in the European Union, that it is an area that deserves further attention. And then consequently also policymakers to look at the issue in more detail.
We'll go on talking about that, because it really is a fascinating subject. But obviously our time is limited, so we have to move on. Another thing that I wanted to discuss with you was this very interesting Master of Psychology in Forensic Psychology, which you have been very much involved in. I think you wrote the curriculum for it. And I mean, it's become a bit of a joke now, you know, these programs we see on the television are pushing forensic psychology really to the fore and making it very much a sort of mediatic thing. But obviously it's a very serious field. And obviously you felt as a department a need to develop this master. So tell us a little bit about the, give us a bit of an overview of what it says, what it does.
Yes, okay. So basically the department has, I think it's now been 3 years working on, developing, extending its master's program. The Department of Psychology has an undergraduate psychology program, but that in order to work or to be given a warrant as a psychologist, you need to have training at master's level. And until 3 years ago, until this year, we provided training in the fields or in the areas of clinical counseling and educational psychology. And we're very proud to say, in fact, that this has been happening for now for about, I think it's 15 years or 10 years, I'm not sure exactly, but we have produced a significant number of clinical counseling and educational psychologists. However, there always has been felt the gap again, that there are other areas of psychology where we need to train people to practice and therefore provide training at postgraduate level. So this year, since the past 3 years, we were tasked with developing programs for health psychology and for forensic psychology, which both opened posts for trainees this October. And I was sort of given the responsibility of the Masters in Forensic Psychology, given my background in criminology and my publications in the area, my research in the area. And essentially, yes, like you say, forensic psychology has become very popular. It's been popularized in the media. In fact, for example, until last year, my undergraduate unit in Introduction to Forensic and Criminal Psychology used to be an elective. And I used to have something like 200 students every time. And everybody would come thinking, it's going to be about CSI and criminal profiling and whatnot. They're often quite disappointed with the science behind it and the theoretical baggage that needs to be learnt. But nonetheless, it is a popular course. This year we opened the doors to 3 trainees. It's very fieldwork intense, so we cannot train a lot of people because you have to place them within settings where they can be supervised by forensic psychologists. And within our country, there are a very limited number of forensic psychologists who can provide this very, very close supervision. So we decided to start with a very small number of trainees for this particular year. The course addresses a number of learning outcomes. We expect our students to be sort of very well versed within the theoretical frameworks that surround forensic psychology. So they have a large input of theoretical background. Much of this is done with our other psychology trainees. So as a group, we've got a large number of trainees because now we have 5 streams. So for certain units, they are together, research methods, psychopathology, things like that. And then I have them for the specialized units where they learn about criminal offending, victimology, substance abuse, etc.
So it's not for everyone. I mean, it's somebody who goes for this must really feel very much as though that, that's what they want to do. This is,
absolutely.
It must be very, psychology at that level is very taxing. I mean, I know that from the friends I have who are working in the field. And in this particular area, I would have thought even more so than usual, really, where you're dealing with people who have, had very difficult backgrounds and are in difficult situations.
Absolutely. Working with forensic populations is not easy. Young people get excited about the notions of it, but in reality, it's pretty hard graft. But it is also very rewarding. And the benefits for society are intense. I mean, I think sort of what we also did as a department was negotiate with the authorities to recognize the need for this, obviously to create placements for us, because our students are twice a week, 2 full days, 9 hours a week on placement. So they are working. For example, this semester they were working within the Department of Probation and Parole, And the coming semester, they will be placed at Corradino Correctional Facility. So obviously, we had to negotiate with the authorities to recognize that there is a need for this, and then create the placements for the students. Because obviously, this creates a disruption in the system to have these other people there on training. But we had a lot of collaboration. I think the authorities are also recognizing how important it is that forensic psychologists find a place within our structures, especially in view of the recently adopted, well, it's been a few years now, Restorative Justice Act, and the introduction of parole, whereby people on entry into custodial sentencing have the opportunity to apply for parole, and consequently need to be assessed, a care plan developed. Very often the role of the forensic psychologist is essential in both the assessment and the development and follow-up of the care plan. So I think structures have been set up, a multi-society, the Restorative Justice Act, the Drug Dependency Act, last February or March, I'm not so sure, whereby the need for professional training for psychologists in this area has been really highlighted.
And one hopes, one imagines, that there will be job opportunities for these students when they finish their course.
Absolutely. We hope within the public sector that jobs definitely will be created for such individuals, especially following the intense investment that the university makes for such individuals. To train three people, the investment is very large.
But hopefully, again, at the end of the day, they'll be there to train others.
Absolutely.
That come behind. Another project which you've been involved in, which I was absolutely fascinated to read about in actual fact, is this project concerning the European Federation of Journalists, Journalists at Risk, Threats, Challenges and Perspectives. This is a project where you are examining the challenges, shall we say, of journalistic life, existence, what can be done to keep them safe, and highlighting the various problems and challenges that there are. First of all, how did you get into this? Because it seems a little bit sort of perhaps not your usual.
Okay. Definitely, it's not about drugs, but my initial training was as a social psychologist. So I've always been very interested in media. And clearly this is very much a link to that. But this is also a study on victimization, essentially, which is a really important aspect of criminology. And I've also been involved in some publications with regards victimization. So it has been an interest of mine, but specifically, once again, this is another Council of Europe initiative. This time, rather than the Pompidou Group, it's the Department of Information Society. And the Council of Europe has recently launched a platform whereby it has engaged with a number of partners, most notably European journalistic and international journalistic associations, to safeguard the safety of journalists and the promotion of journalism in a democratic society. And sort of the main rationale behind this platform, and as well behind this study, is that in order to have a democracy, you have to have freedom of expression. I mean, this is clearly outlined in Article 10 in the Convention. And without a freedom of expression and a free media and a free journalistic society, democracy cannot be secured. So in order to have democracy, you have to have journalists who feel that they can report what they should be reporting. Now, unfortunately, this is not actually the case in many European countries, in many Council of Europe member states, where we have seen some very, all of us know about the Charlie Hebdo killings, where individuals entered the offices of this newspaper, satirical newspaper, and murdered a number of journalists. Charlie Hebdo was something which, shocked Europe. But journalists are threatened. They experience what we call unwarranted interference on a daily basis. We don't hear about this, but there are a number of watchdogs that alert us to this. For example, one of the members of the platform reports regularly to the platform incidences of unwarranted interference with genders. When we say unwarranted interference, we're talking about things like actual assaults, but perhaps more subtle threats on both journalists or on their family members or on their friends or on journalistic sources. And very often this unwarranted interference emanates not just from individuals but from authorities who feel threatened by the reporting of journalists. So this is a very much a political issue of enormous significance for democracy in Europe, and one which in a number of Council of Europe member states there appears to be limited freedom for journalists to express their opinions freely. Another issue that I wanted to highlight is that when journalists are threatened either by the authorities or by, it could be by editors or by advertisers or by interest groups, they are often treated with impunity, which means they are never served justice. Okay. They are often imprisoned. There are many countries where a number of journalists find themselves imprisoned simply for reporting things which the state or which interests or powerful groups find to be threatening to them. And this impunity is obviously very threatening to a democratic society. Basically because journalists might feel afraid. So what we're exploring here is the prevalence of victimization, but also the fear, the associated fear that journalists experience as a result of impunity. And consequently, self-censorship. So is there a chilling effect to all of this? Does this cause journalists to basically shut up, to be quiet about what they would report? The study is, phase one of the project has been completed, so we've basically come up with a research tool which we're going to be piloting this month. And then we hope that the study will be sort of disseminated in sometime in March. And we will start having some results probably towards the summer with a final publication at the end of the year.
I look forward to that. I was very chuffed when I went on the website to see that the working group is actually led by yourself and that the Department of Psychology and the Faculty of Social Wellbeing actually and the University was actually mentioned on the website.
Right, yes.
So I was delighted to see your name there. And I'd like to thank you for being on the program today.
Thank you so much.
Professor Marilyn Clark.
Thank you.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il-program li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġju plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.